This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
No, it never is too early to start talking presidential elections, you know. The White House is getting serious about jobs. Again, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcast.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you with us. It is the 13th of June today, and one hesitates to mention this on an otherwise perfectly pleasant Monday. But the calendar sadly does not lie. We are only 17 short months from Election Day, a year and a half almost. So it is, of course, time to start talking the politics of the American economy. On the same day that would-be Republican candidates were set to debate up in New Hampshire, President Obama went to North Carolina today to talk jobs. He toured a high-tech lighting factory, and he got some recommendations from his Jobs and Competitiveness Council, things like boosting tourism and creating clean tech jobs. So how's that working out so far? Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale starts us off.
Running for office, Obama vowed to create 5 million green energy jobs within a decade. But the White House estimates so far there are fewer than 800,000 new jobs building electric car batteries and making new LED light bulbs, like at the factory Obama toured today.
I want to see the LEDs and solar panels and wind turbines and electric cars of tomorrow made right here in the U.S. of A.
But that green energy strategy is far from enough to reduce unemployment. That's because foreign factories are meeting the demand for goods, says Gary Bertless at the Brookings Institution.
To the extent that that increase in demand is fulfilled by overseas production, we're not increasing the demand for workers here in the United States.
Obama is betting that demand will come eventually from energy-efficient products. But the President's Council on Jobs today issued much more traditional recommendations for boosting employment, cutting red tape for construction permits and small business loans, getting rid of tourist visa restrictions. Business circles gave that a big thumbs up today. Matt McDonald at Hamilton Place Strategy says when the President talks green jobs, that's all it is.
The challenge for the White House is that that is going to be fundamentally an anecdotal story for them and not necessarily a big numbers-driven story where they can point to month over month.
Eventually, green technologies promise to generate lots of new jobs. The question is whether that'll be soon enough for Obama to save his own. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On the theory, perhaps, that clean tech jobs are only going to get the United States so far, no less a voice than the president's former chief economic advisor, Larry Summers, is calling for more stimulus, another $100 billion or so for infrastructure, more tax breaks, and more federal aid to cities and states as well. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to find out whether that might work.
If the economy were a basketball team, it'd need to pull a Mavs-type streak of three-point baskets. In economic terms, that'd be around 300,000 new jobs every month. So far this year, we haven't hit that. So let's look at some game plans. How about a lower payroll tax on employers to encourage them to hire?
I think it's an exercise in futility.
That's liberal economist James Galbraith at the University of Texas.
You can give a few tax incentives, but they aren't going to offset the basic caution that business has when faced with the fact that it doesn't think its markets are going to grow very quickly.
But what if you could boost spending by consumers or businesses? Galbraith says banks are too scared to lend and consumers are sunk in debt. So what about government? A few hundred billion for new schools and roads. It's not unthinkable, even to conservative economist Bruce Bartlett, who worked in the Reagan administration.
Increased infrastructure spending by government would be highly beneficial. The problem there is the long lag times.
You need to hire architects and engineers just to get started. Plus, putting more workers on the government payroll or cutting taxes so employers can add to their payrolls, well, it all adds to the deficit. Who will vote for that?
As hard as it is technically to come up with something that might work, finding something that would work politically is, I think, quite impossible at this point.
I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There was some to-ing and fro-ing on Wall Street today, and then the major indices ended pretty much where they started. We'll have the details. Well, you know when we'll have the details. Two very big, very different organizations are grappling with similar problems. Data hacking. Citigroup was hacked 3 weeks ago. The bank apparently waited to tell its credit card holders while they investigated and then got replacement cards ready for them. The International Monetary Fund, meanwhile, has kept largely mum about its own hack attack and what confidential files it has about helping to run the global economy that might have been exposed. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more now on the state of corporate anti-hacking preparedness.
No matter who you bank with or where you shop, chances are you've gotten one of those phone calls or emails saying your information has been compromised. Jonathan Weiner investigated international crime for the Clinton administration and now consults on cybersecurity for APCO Worldwide.
Consumer companies like Best Buy and Target, financial companies like Capital One Chase, Bank of America, Citibank, everybody's got the problem.
And almost everybody fumbles how they handle it, being too secretive or saying too much. And that's largely because they don't have a plan in place to deal with all the Hydra heads of a data breach, says Weiner.
Got to have a protocol, and the protocol needs to include a legal side, a forensic side, an IT side, and a public affairs side.
Speed and competence are key, says David Evans. He's the CEO of Sykester. It recently teamed up with Microsoft to study the best ways for companies to communicate data breaches on social networks.
You don't have the option of sitting it out. You really do need to get on Twitter and address the issue because the users that are affected by an outage or a breach are going to be discussing it there with or without you.
Evans says it's tricky because companies need to wait until they have enough information to make a meaningful announcement and a team set up to handle the situation so they don't get flooded with phone calls from panicking customers. But if companies wait too long, they risk looking untrustworthy. A Senate bill would help clear that up. It would put time limits in place for companies to report a data breach. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Funny thing happened to my Facebook account about a month or so ago. It, too, was hacked. Truth is, it's just been way too hard to get the company to help me fix it, so I've pretty much given up, and I have been living Facebook-free ever since. Beautiful part is, I don't really miss it, and it turns out I may not be the only person suffering Facebook fatigue. A report out today says the number of users in the U.S. may actually be falling. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Facebook is still expanding globally, but in places where it's been around for a long time, like the US and the UK, traffic may be falling off. Analysts at Inside Facebook, which tracks the social network obsessively, say that last month, 6 million fewer Americans logged into Facebook than the month before.
You know, it could be a blip, but you're still talking about a company that's closing in at 700 million users.
Michael Gartenberg's a social media analyst at Gartner. He says it's too soon to call this a trend, but with Facebook planning a $100 billion IPO, this is not the best time for the company to start losing its audience. And some analysts think Facebook fatigue may be setting in.
Absolutely.
Jay Kuthrell is a tech consultant and was an early Facebook adopter.
I think I had 1,000 or so friends or more. I couldn't keep track of it.
Ask your own friends about the annoying Facebook posts they received and be prepared for a barrage. Religious quotes, political tirades, bragging, even your baby's first steps are likely to annoy someone. And then there are the games.
Pokes and vampire bites or zombie bites or mob hits. But from my point of view, it's noise.
Michael Gartenberg at Gartner says if Facebook is going to keep growing, it will have to build better tools that let everyone turn down the noise and find the messages that matter to them. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
There's a certain logistical rhythm to the way illegal drugs get into this country. They are made, or grown, or mixed, and brought to the U.S.-Mexican border. Smugglers get them across into the southwestern part of the United States. Law enforcement tries, sometimes succeeds, but often fails in stopping them. And so illegal drugs are a multi-hundred-billion-dollar-a-year business. Today we begin a three-part series, The Drug War at Home, from Fronteras, a regional public radio reporting project in the Southwest. Today, Devin Brown takes us to one particular smuggling route.
Roberto Hernandez is in prison, and he will be until 2019. But 2 years ago, he ran a complex drug trafficking organization in southern Arizona out of a town most locals pronounce Casa Grande. His organization did two things. One, move drugs north to Phoenix, and two, move money south to Mexico. Detectives with the Pinal County Sheriff's Office learned this through a wiretap in 2009. They estimate that at any given time, Hernandez had between 50 and 100 people working for him.
The stash house workers, the actual load drivers, the people that are looking out for vehicles, somebody to go buy supplies, the list goes on.
This is Detective Ray Hinojos with Pinal County's Narcotics Task Force, driving me along the same roads Hernandez's smugglers used, retracing their routes, which were always through the Tohono O'odham Indian Reservation, a 5,000-square-mile stretch of land on the border. Hernandez's chain began with backpackers, men, usually Mexican nationals, recruited to walk for as many as 10 days through the desert with 40 to 100 pounds of marijuana strapped to their backs. Their destination? What the detectives call a layup, a little spot just off the interstate where the backpackers would radio in their mile marker and wait for a load driver who would
pull right up, stop, pop the trunk, throw two or three backpacks in, and we're gone. And then a couple hours, maybe a little bit later, another vehicle would come, get the bodies. Once they saw that the dope or whatever got off okay and everything's all right.
Meanwhile, the drugs headed to Casa Grande. Scouts and lookouts on mountaintops and vacant houses made sure that the drivers took the right route.
They'll get up to a high enough vantage point, and then that's when they're going to tell either the desert people, okay, it's cool to get on the highway or get on the road, or you know what, stop, stop, stop.
It's time-intensive and expensive to move drugs. The sheriff's office estimates drug trafficking organizations spend $100 for every pound of marijuana they move from the border through Casa Grande to Phoenix. During peak season, Hernandez was moving 1,000 pounds every week, bringing in about $500 for every pound of pot sold on the street.
There's actually a lot of money being spent, but if there wasn't that much money to be made, you know, where would they be?
Well, eventually, they went to jail. Law enforcement arrested Hernandez and 32 others in October of 2009 and seized nearly $30 million worth of cars, houses, weapons, and cash. Later, Pinal County Sheriff Paul Babiou told reporters at a press conference that this was a great victory.
This actually crippled an entire transportation network, bringing drugs from Mexico up through the Tohono O'odham Indian Nation into Pinal County.
But Hernandez's drug trafficking organization, or DTO, was just one of many that moved drugs for the Sinaloa cartel, which controls this area of the border. Again, Ray Hinojos.
They're not just entrusting one DTO to move their shipments. They're liable to have 10 of them, 10 DTOs, and nobody knows about each other. So that way, if one's not doing its job, I can start pushing more weight over this way for this one that's doing a good job.
So with one drug trafficking organization dismantled, another will now just take on that supply and move it north. Currently, the Pinal County Sheriff's Office says it has several more traffickers under investigation. In Phoenix, I'm Devin Brown for Marketplace.
Tomorrow on the series, the economics of smuggling along the interstate highway system and into this country's big cities. Coming up, buying healthy is often just about making it easy.
move it towards the middle and call it out with some signage, then somebody might say, you know, I might try it. I don't usually get that stuff.
But first, let's do the numbers. After bouncing around for a while, the Dow Industrials ended flat today, closed at 11,952. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ down 4 points, about a tenth percent, 2639 at the bell. The S&P 500 edged up a tenth percent, 8 points, finished at 1271. Financial firms beat back the bears. Citigroup banked more than 3% today. Morgan Stanley up just under 3%. Bank of America picked up about 1.5% today. Deals also helped keep things afloat. Wendy's shares sizzled up more than 0.75% today on news that is going to unload most of its stake in Arby's. Never much cared for Arby's, anyway. Wendy's I like. VF Corporation, home to the North Face and Wrangler, among other brands, said it would buy Timberland. Stock in the bootmaker stepped up nearly 45% today, 4.5%. VF shares packed on 10%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.98%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Commerce Department reports on retail sales for May. The Labor Department issues the Producer Price Index for May. And Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke delivers opening remarks at a conference on debt hosted by the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. That stands for American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you're a car guy or a car girl, chances are pretty good you've heard of Bob Lutz. He is arguably the car guy. Over the past 47 years, he has worked for Ford, BMW, and Chrysler. He was the vice chairman of General Motors from 2001 till last year. And Bob Lutz has more than a few things to say about how American car makers came to find themselves in their present predicament. He says them in his new book, Car Guys versus Bean Counters. Bob Lutz, good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So I'm going to read you back to yourself just to get us going here, playing off that line in the title about car guys versus bean counters. And here's what you have to say about the bean counters. It's time to stop, you say, the dominance of the number crunchers, living in their perfect, predictable, financially projected world who fail time and again, and give the reins to the product guys of either gender, those with vision and passion for the customers and their product or service. So that'd be you, right? The product guy with the passion?
Well, first of all, let me say you almost should have done the audio version.
Well, thank you.
But I don't necessarily place myself on the hero list, but it is true that giving the customer the absolute finest automobile that General Motors could possibly produce has proven to be the correct approach to the automobile business, because this finance-generated effort to skimp and see how much cost can we strip out before people actually protest, I think is something that's taught in the business schools, and it has been extremely damaging to American business, and it doesn't have to be that way.
Well, let's explain how you would like it to be and the way really that you think it ought to be, certainly in cars anyway. You stress in this book the importance of design, and the downfall, you say, of the American automobile industry has been putting design as an afterthought to those numbers guys.
Yeah, because that's all part of the rational approach, where the vehicle was more or less defined by numbers, interior dimensions, luggage compartment dimensions, overall length, et cetera, et cetera. It was then handed over to design, and design was basically told to put a wrapper around it.
Well, what happened then in Detroit where nobody, except maybe you, seemed to realize this?
Well, what happened is I'm really kind of a holdover from the 60s. When the place was basically run by the product enthusiasts, people like Harley Earl, after him, mm-hmm. Bill Mitchell. Mm-hmm. I mean, these were designers who were on the covers of magazines, and finance was counting the money. And then the scientific management took over. And, of course, for a while, the company lived off of momentum. But there just was not enough focus on the vehicle itself.
So all of that said, for your obvious passion for the subject, for your experience, for your successes, which we have to grant you, how come the identifying line above your name on the title of this book says former vice chairman of General Motors instead of former CEO of General Motors.
This is the downside of being a creative person who does not play the political game too well. If I had, for instance, been a little bit more circumspect in my dealings with Lee Iacocca and perhaps had held my mouth, I might well have been his successor at Chrysler Corporation.
Seems kind of an easy answer. You shut your mouth too much.
I tend to be a person when I don't know something, I say, I don't know, I'll have to look it up. I think boards like a CEO who is totally buttoned up, has all the figures. People with my personality generally don't make CEO.
Bob Lutz, former vice chairman of General Motors. He's got a new book out about that company and the car industry and American business writ large. It's called Car Guys versus Bean Counters. Bob Lutz, thanks a lot for your time.
Hey, thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
I stopped by a GM dealership while I was in China last week, by the way, where the company makes way more money than it does here. There's a slideshow on our website, including the part where they try to sell me two cars. It's marketplace.org. If the supermarket industry had its way, we'd all probably only be allowed to shop when we were totally starving, and we'd have to leave our grocery lists in the car to encourage random purchases of stuff we don't really need. Even the most aware shoppers among us aren't much of a match for marketing geniuses who've designed stores for maximum temptation and maximum sales. But what if grocery stores used what they know about us and our buying habits for good instead of evil? From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, PA, Gregory Warner reports.
From the moment you walk into a grocery store, your path is being plotted. That tower of Pepsis you pass five times, that's no accident. Pepsi paid good rent for that well-traveled bit of real estate at the end of the aisle. Another high-traffic zone is the dairy case. Ever notice how many other products are clustered around it that aren't dairy?
It's all cross-merchandise.
Paul Curtis is store manager at the Fresh Grocer in North Philadelphia. It's a supermarket known for bringing fresh produce to low-income areas. But, like any store, Fresh Grocer is also trying to sell as much food as possible. So, right next to the ever-popular dairy case, Curtis has stationed the hot dogs. Now he's got you thinking cheese dogs.
Yeah. Keep going. You run into your burgers, and you got your relishes, your beans. You're thinking, well, I got a grill. I got kids coming, you got your hugs, you got more chips, and you just keep going all around.
So you come in for a quart of milk, next thing you know you're buying burger buns for that barbecue you just decided to throw. Every square inch of the store is charted, and every manufacturer is angling for better turf. Into this fray walks Karen Glanz.
Hi, Karen Glanz. I'm a professor of epidemiology and nursing at the University of Pennsylvania.
Which is a confusing job title because what Karen spends most of her time doing is studying supermarkets.
Trying to learn from what commercial marketers have been doing all along, see if we can't turn some of that to health advantage.
Glanz has partnered with this store to help rejigger its aisles and hopefully reprogram shoppers to choose healthier food. For example, people tend to buy what's on the middle shelf just because it's at eye level. And research also shows that when we're overwhelmed with choices,
There's a lot of salad dressing out here.
We're more likely to rely on shelf talkers. Those are those cardboard ads that pop out at you from the shelf.
If we wanted to take all the light dressing, move it towards the middle, and call it out with some signage, then somebody might say, you know, I might try it. I don't usually get that stuff.
Here's another example. Research shows that we're more likely to choose healthy food when it's placed right next to its less healthy cousin.
Just put it directly next to it, right in their face.
Paul Curtis has worked here 15 years. He started pushing carts as a teenager. He told me he was surprised how well this trick works. He used it to sell more whole wheat pizza and more multigrain low-sodium hoagies. But follow Glanz's research all the way, and the happy partnership between nutritionist and grocery store marketeer starts to crumble. She says lots of studies show that it's not enough for stores to promote healthy choices. They have to unsell the bad stuff.
That's a very tricky proposition because nobody wants to go against a product.
I mean, nobody wants product to sell on the shelf.
Because No supermarket wants to make any food hard to find or lose the high profit on processed food. So other health advocates are pushing for laws restricting where high-fat foods get positioned, with particular focus on the checkout aisle.
So it's an aisle that you're kind of forced through, unless they go through self-checkout.
Self-checkout doesn't have the gauntlet of candy bars. Some industry consultant calculated that an average American woman could lose 4 pounds a year just going through self-checkout.
And the self-checkout doesn't have any of that distraction.
So about that distraction, here's one last tip. Glenn says we're more likely to buy something sweet at the end of our shopping trip if we've been good about buying healthy for the rest of the time. So she says as you leave the store, treat yourself to an apple. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
You want to see for yourself how supermarkets influence our buying decisions? You know what to do. The slideshow is at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which Ohio Governor John Kasich puts an in-your-face exclamation point on the just-ended National Basketball Association season. Dallas beat Miami and LeBron James last night in the finals, 4-2. James, as even the non-basketball aware among us probably know, left his hometown club, the Cleveland Cavaliers, for Miami last summer amid great hoopla, which is why the official proclamation by Kasich today was so great. Here's just part of it. Whereas, it says, as those things always do, NBA Finals MVP Dirk Nowitzki chose to re-sign with the Dallas Mavericks last summer, remaining loyal to the team, city, and fans for whom he has played his entire career. Now, therefore, I, John Kasich, governor of Ohio, do name the Dallas Mavericks honorary Ohioans. Marketplace angle? Yeah, not a one. I just thought it was pretty funny. Nice poke in the eye. Anyway, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow ended right where it started. The NASDAQ off 4 points, about 0.1%. The S&P tipped up 8 points. That is 0.7%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back on The Big Show. Putting a lot of energy into your kids' achievements is all well and good to a point.
If you have too many kids, you can't invest that heavily in any one of them because you go crazy.
Lessons for the father of four tomorrow on the Freakonomics of Parenting. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.